All right, well, we are on lesson five of our series called Kiss the Son, and we've been working through sort of the Bible's teaching on government, what it is that the duties and definition of government is according to the scriptures. And last week I was away, so I'll just pick up with a little bit of review of where we are in the class. I've been putting the thesis before you every week. I actually think this is the first time it's not in the handout, but I'll just say it. And hopefully you're starting to really know this thesis inside and out. It is the duty of all government to acknowledge Christ as Lord, and within the limits of its ordained power, promote the Christian religion. And that's been the thing that I've been trying to advance, is the teaching of the scriptures. And thus far, that's been the main focus as we've been doing a sort of a survey of the Bible and the biblical text from the Old Testament to the New, of how it is that the Bible describes the duties of kings, which are really the paradigm government that the scriptures give to us. Kings, and by extension to all rulers in every form of government. Just to remind you, because it's been a few weeks since the beginning of the class, and at the beginning we sort of gave some reasons for embarking on this, and I want to revisit why it is that we're embarking on this. And, you know, positively, I've already mentioned, it's in order for us to understand the Bible's teaching on this. It's good for us, if the Bible teaches on a subject, to know it, and to know what we believe, because the scriptures are our final rule of authority in all things related to life and doctrine. And so, just on that basis alone, if God has taught it, it's worth us knowing. Negatively, I think I've been wanting to sort of take on some hardened positions in our world that sometimes take the status of almost biblical truth as if they reach that kind of level of authority, but are not as obvious as they pretend to be. I hope that's been your experience as we've looked at the Bible's teaching, that there are some things that people say about government and Christian relationship with the government that aren't as obvious as they pretend to be. I'd say there are a few fictions out there that I'd like this class to somewhat dispel, or at least raise in question. One fiction would be simply the idea that the separation of church and state means that the Christian religion has nothing to do with politics. That would be an overstatement. Now, politics is not the sum and summary of what we are doing in church on Sundays. It's not even all that relevant in a day-to-day way or week-to-week way. And yet, it would be wrong to have a kind of sense that what we do on Sunday has nothing to do with the political sphere. I hope you see that as we've been looking at the scripture's testimony. We've talked about things like the fact that politics and government really is the invention of God. God has ordained it, and he governs it by his word and his rule. You know, another fiction would be that we as Christians have no political aspirations, or should have no political aspirations. Sometimes there's this idea that all the sum and summary of the Christian faith and of the church is merely preaching to save individual souls for a future eternal purpose of souls being in heaven. Now, is that a really significant thing? Is it even much closer to the central thing? Yes, that is the central thing, the preaching of the gospel. That's the task of the church. And yet, as we've looked at it, I think we've seen from the scriptures that God would have us disciple men, and not only men, but he calls us to disciple the nations. So men at every station of life, whether low or high, and an implication of that, of discipling men at every level of society in all the nations, would be that we are teaching men how to order the affairs that are under their authority in a way that's in keeping with the glory of Christ and the glory of God, right? So at that point, this has all kinds of spillover implications for men who occupy high positions of government. And we should keep those in mind as we approach this subject. The third fiction that sometimes gets bandied about, and I won't deal with entirely, but I hope you would see that this is not a true statement. You know, sometimes people say it's actually better for Christians to live under ungodly government. Have you ever heard this idea? That, you know, the church is better off when it's persecuted. And sometimes people will even quote Tertullian, a very wonderful quote of Tertullian, right? The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And then they'll say, you know, that ought to be our political aspiration. You know, basically, if persecution is good for Christians, what we want is more persecution. We should welcome it. And I would just say, you know, that's a wonderful thing to say in the West, where we enjoy such freedom. It's a very naive thing to say. You know, talk to the church in Russia about the persecutions that it endured and the consequence on the church in the early 20th century of some of the really heavy persecution by atheistic communist governments against it. You know, the church is not thriving in Russia in a way we would want it to be. And it's not necessarily always true. Now, we do have other counterexamples, right? China is a wonderful example of a way in which the church is exploding and doing so under some duress. And so, you know, God has his purposes, and even governments won't foil his purposes. But we ought not sort of idealize persecution as the greatest state a Christian could live under. It's not an accurate way to think, or even a biblical way to think. And the Bible gives us all kinds of parameters and even examples for us. We've talked about how Paul, for instance, he endures persecution cheerfully, doesn't he? Yes. But does he try to convince those that he stands before that his cause is just, that his crime is in fact false, the crime he's accused of committing, that he's innocent? You know, he has all of those appeals and even seeks justice, true justice, from those kings and princes that he comes before. So those are some of the fictions that I hope are on shaky ground given what we've talked about up to this point. Today I want to move on from the biblical case, and I want to start in on the question, not only is it biblical, but is it confessional? Does this, what I've been advancing, correspond to what we believe as a church and as a denomination, the summary of which is in the Westminster Confession of Faith? So, if you don't know this, we are what's called a confessional church, which means that the pastors, when they stand up to teach you or to preach from the Bible, what we're doing is not merely opening our mouths and spouting our own private interpretation of the Scriptures, our own opinion. No, we're held to account. I have made a vow, actually, as a minister, to receive and adopt the Westminster Confession of Faith as a faithful summary of the Bible's teaching. And we as a church have also made that commitment. The leaders of this church have made that commitment. Which means it's a really important thing for us to ask, not only is it biblical, but is it in keeping with the authorities over us? We are men under authority. I'm a man under authority. And I can't be simply coming up with my own opinions and ideas without that having some consequence if it runs afoul of the standards of our church, which are summarized or contained in the Westminster Confession of Faith. So is it confessional is a really, really big question. And I want to dive in on that question by beginning in the most famous portion of our standards. So what's the most famous portion that every child knows from the youngest of ages in a Presbyterian church? What's the very first thing we teach our good Presbyterian children? Question and answer one, right? Yeah, what is man's chief end? What's the answer? Anyone want to say? Hudson, what is man's chief end? Don't look at it.
Okay, man's chief end is to glorify God.
Good job. Excellent. Excellent. I want you to notice, just by the way, there's a reason that's such a rich little doctrinal summary. There's so much reflection of human life and our purpose in the world and who God is and what Christian life is. You know, just sitting there and reflecting on the fact that we're called to enjoy God is something that is amazing, that actually that is the very beginning point of our Reformed forefathers' theology. It was the enjoyment of God. Man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. I want to notice something really interesting about that answer, and that's that phrase, chief end. What's an end? Does anyone know what an end is? What's that word is being used to describe there?
Purpose.
Yeah, purpose would be a more everyday way of speaking, an end. What is man's chief purpose? Notice what the Catechism doesn't say. It doesn't say that man's only end is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. You know, they could have chosen to say that. Man's only end is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. No, it says that man's highest, his chief end, is to glorify God. And what the Catechism is recognizing there is actually that human life is filled with all kinds of ends, all kinds of purposes. Right? You could think of, well, there's just so many examples of this. You guys have been living this morning with all kinds of purposes at work in your life. You know, you have a job, and the purpose of that job is for sustaining your life and the life of your family. You have a car for the purpose of getting to that job. You have, you fill up that car with gas in order for the purpose of it running, right? We're very purposive creatures, and we're always pursuing some kind of purpose and many kinds of purposes. And what the Catechism is saying is that all of those purposes, if you were to chart them on a piece of paper, they'd create a tree shape. You'd be able to trace them and even make hierarchy of them. And that hierarchy would end in one single place. The very highest tip-top point of that tree in the hierarchy of your ends would be to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Which is why everything actually in human life, the totality of it, every activity that we undertake as Christians, none of it is exempt or astray from that central purpose. You could, or you should, be able to chart all of your life's purposes under that highest purpose. All of it sort of traces up to the glorification of God and the enjoyment of Him. Here's another way of just saying that. And that's the word of Paul, right? Paul says, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Notice how he starts with the most humble of actions, right? You woke up and you ate and you drank to feed your body. Well, Paul says, no, it's not just to feed your body. Actually, that's arranged too, under the glory of God. So at the simplest level of everyday acts, it's also at more complex acts and more important people. You know, civil governments too possess this chief end. They possess this chief end, to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Here's Hodge. So A.A. Hodge has a commentary. A.A. Hodge, just by the way, is a 19th century son of Charles Hodge. His father is slightly more famous than he is. Charles Hodge was a Princeton theologian, probably one of the greatest, maybe, American theologians of the 1800s. You know, I think we have a systematic theology probably behind me somewhere, but Hodge had a son. I can't remember what AA stands for. Do you remember what? Arthur?
Alexander, maybe?
Alexander? Yeah, maybe. Archibald, Alec? No. Anyway, I'm mixing up people here. But anyway, AA Hodge was also, you know, a great theologian in his own right, also a Princeton professor at Old Princeton before it went liberal in the 1800s. And he writes a very prominent commentary on the Confession of Faith. And here's what Hodge says, sort of making the exact same point. If the glory of God is the chief end of man, it must be the chief end equally of all nations and communities of men. And it ought to be made the governing purpose of every individual in all his relations and actions, public and official, as well as private and personal. And if the glory of God is his chief end, it is that to which all other objects and designs are subordinated as ends. You know, I would just say that connects pretty well to our thesis. It is the duty of all government to acknowledge Christ as Lord. The glory of God is contained in Christ, and the acknowledgement of Christ as Lord is the responsibility of every man, not just in his private hearts. You know, he's just in his inner being, his inner thinking, but actually at every level, in all of his duties, in all of his offices, his responsibilities, his authority that he exercises, that chief end governs it all. I want you to hold on to that idea, because actually I think question and answer one of the Catechism appears in the next portion of the standards that I want to look at, which is, of course, the most substantial portion, which is chapter 23 of the Westminster Standards, which is entitled Of the Civil Magistrate. So this is the Confession's focused attention and most in-depth attention to the matter of what God's purpose for government is. And that's what I want to look at with you now. So we're just going to kind of pick through this statement, chapter 23, and we'll pull out key phrases and reflect on them and their implications and think about what our forefathers, our Reformed forefathers, were trying to teach us in this confession. So here's what chapter 23, section 1 says. God, the supreme Lord and King of all the world, hath ordained civil magistrates to be under him over the people for his own glory. That's where I see question and answer 1 reappearing here. For his own glory and the public good. And to this end hath armed them with the power of the sword for the defense and encouragement of them that are good and for the punishment of evildoers. You know, that statement, I would just say, is really full, chock full of really rich theology. And theology concentrated at this central question of the purpose of government. So we could just, let's just pick it apart phrase by phrase. So we have, first of all, this mention of God, the supreme Lord and King. This is a simple confession or summary of what we've seen when we looked at the Bible, isn't it? That Jesus Christ is the ruler of kings on earth, that he is supreme, that there is no authority that does not come from him. You remember he says that to Pilate? He says to Pilate, all authority is from above, and it is only yours because it's been granted to you from above. So God is the supreme Lord and King. Nor does it have, you know, well, what this means is that government doesn't have any higher, it doesn't bottom out in anything higher than God. You know, I just say there's sometimes this really goofy idea in the Christian right in America. I remember Glenn Beck saying this a decade ago, and it was very annoying when he did. You know, Glenn Beck said the Constitution was inspired by God. Remember this? You know, we should just reject that as just utter blasphemy. It's an attempt to put a man-made document on the same level and say that the hierarchy of government ends in the Constitution. Sometimes that's an idea that people have that, you know, basically the Constitution is above our rulers. And I would even acknowledge that fact. I would say, yes, we are a constitutional republic. That is the highest document under God. Right? So God is the highest. He is the supreme. And we need to be really clear in our thinking and not have idolatry sneaking in. And that sort of thing is just, it's just bad. We should reject that. No matter who's saying that sort of thing, it's bad. God is the supreme Lord and King. And him and his word is what rules it. Here's Hodge again. Hodge makes a point that I've tried to make in previous weeks. He says, some have supposed that the right or legitimate authority of human government has its foundation ultimately in the consent of the governed, or the will of the majority, or in some imaginary social compact entered into by the forefathers of the race at the origin of social life. It is self-evident that the divine will is the source of all government. Hodge goes on, hence the present providential governor of the physical universe and ruler among the nations is Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews, to whose will all laws should be conformed, and whom all nations and all rulers of men should acknowledge and serve. So Hodge, making in many respects, in more short form, what I've been trying to convince you of in past weeks. Yeah.
You know, the statement that the consent of the governed or the will of the majority of civil, those words are being used right now. That being stated not too long ago.
Yeah.
In the middle of some, you know, which contest it is, but that's very, very common.
Yes.
In our society today.
Yes, very common. We talked about this, I think, 2 weeks ago when I said that the voters are not Washington's boss. God is Washington's boss. And ultimately, they need to answer to him. and will answer to him. They don't answer to a tribunal of public opinion. That's not actually what stands at the top of the hierarchy as God has ordained it. I think Hodge is really insightful there. Here's the next phrase. He's the supreme Lord and King of all the world. This is the source of that, or it's a similar idea to that one that maybe you've heard R.C. Sproul make, the famous moment where he said there's no stray molecule in the universe. And he was riffing on Abraham Kuyper's idea that every square inch of creation stands under his authority, which is to say that there are no governments that exist outside of his supremacy. We don't have a Christian world and then a non-Christian world. It all belongs to Jesus, and it's all under him. All are held to this account. The next phrase is, he hath ordained civil magistrates to be under him. Again, making a similar point. God is at the very top of this hierarchy. And then this little phrase, for his own glory. I mentioned earlier that I think this is a connection to question and answer one. Government is ordained for his glory. But I would just say that that little phrase ought to open up all kinds of reflections for us. What would it look like for a government to operate according to the glory of God? You know, I would say maybe the easier way to get at that is to say, what does it not look like for a government to operate according to the glory of God? Well, look around you. I don't want to be too hard on our government, because we actually do have quite a lot of blessing in our country, and even stability of rule is one of those things that we have as a blessing that other governments and other places have not preserved. So in one sense, I don't want to be too critical, but just think about the ways in which the sexual revolution has been blessed and advanced by our government. Even instituted in law, right? No-fault divorce being something that was established, weakening the oaths between men. There's a quote later that Hodge is, where Hodge gets after that direct idea some 100 years in advance of this ever even coming up in legislation in America. Here's what John Calvin says along these very lines, talking about the purpose of government being the glory of God. For political laws, he says, are not only enacted with reference to earthly affairs in order that men should maintain mutual equity with each other. How many people restrict it merely to that? Human law is just earthly affairs, and all we're doing is making sure that things are peaceful, just here and now. Right? That's the highest vision that most people have today of human law. And John Calvin says, no. He goes on. And should, where did I pick up here? In order that men should maintain mutual equity with each other and should follow and observe what is right, but, Calvin says, that they should exercise themselves in the veneration of God. The fear of God is the preface of all laws, nor has any profane author ever existed who has not confessed that this is the principal part of a well-constituted state, that all with one consent should reverence and worship God. And when he talks about profane authors there, by the way, Calvin is talking about, on this point, he agrees with Plato. Even Plato made the point that the fear of God, whoever Plato thought was God, stands at the very sort of top of all government. So that's Calvin. The next phrase is, again, another one that I think is worth really meditating on. And the public good, for his own glory and the public good. That would be a really wonderful thing if we could see governments wholeheartedly operating in the interest of the public good. I think what the confession is sort of getting at there is that one of the temptations of leadership is to rule for its own interests. Actually, in the larger Catechism 130, what are the sins of superiors? It captures this fact. The sins of the superiors are an inordinate seeking of themselves, their own glory, ease, profit, or pleasure. Then notice what it says too, commanding things unlawful, or not in the power of inferiors to perform. Here's Hodge. The specific way in which the civil magistrate is to endeavor to advance the glory of God is through the promotion of the good of the community in temporal concerns, including education, morals, physical prosperity, the protection of life and property, and the preservation of order. It's quite the list. He's getting a little more practical and on the ground there with how this influences in a very direct way some of the spheres of government. Thoughts on that? Michael.
Isn't this a direct rebuke to the whole concept of socialism and communism?
How do you see that?
I'm not sure when Hodge is writing.
Yeah.
But the whole idea that it's the specific way is the protection of life and property.
Yeah.
The government taking your property is not that.
Right.
And that's proof positive that all of these endeavors, and I have to say Sacramento majors in it, is completely ungodlike. Everything they do when they take your property and when they take your livelihood is ungodly.
Yeah. We'd want to say that the right of governments to impose taxes would be the one exception, right? So money is, in one sense, property, and the Bible upholds that.
In a manner, not in a completely confiscatory manner that takes your entire livelihood and property.
Yeah. Yeah. Other thoughts, Pat?
So if you take that last paragraph and just remove the reference to God, what's left is something that even extreme leftists would agree with.
Yeah.
Right? There's promote the good of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Education.
Yeah.
Right? Teach your kids about the 27 genders, right?
Yeah.
Right?
Right. It's interesting to think about how this ages, right?
They don't mean what I mean when I say morals.
Yeah.
They use that mean.
Yeah, and it is worth meditating.
It's a fine list.
Yeah.
But you really have to tie it back to what you mean.
Right.
Because it's like everyone agrees that government should do good things.
Right. Well, it's an important reflection of the fact we shouldn't be knee-jerk in our reactions to things. So, for instance, one of the knee-jerk temptations, I think, of the modern age is to say, government screwed up education. They have no interest in it. That has nothing to do with public good. And I just say that is a fairly long-standing tradition of having some interest in education. Even if that interest were to be limited in, are children being educated? It is manifestly and self-evidently part of the common good and public good of a nation that its people be educated. And so even if we would want to say that that should be restricted, and we could talk about endlessly how that might be restricted, it's interesting that Hodge places that under this category of public good, the promotion of public good. You know, for instance, you know, truancy laws have a very long history of being, you know, regardless of whether or not, you know, Christian homeschooling, all those debates set aside. It's good to listen to our forebears, even if we don't quite agree. So I'm not asking you to sign off on everything Hodge is saying here, but we could each learn something from listening to them. Brett?
I would say public education is important to literacy.
Yeah. I don't want to go too far, but I think there is an argument that has been made. And I've heard well-meaning Christians who do not support 27 genders at least attempt to make that argument, that there's some interest, at least, whether or not the current public education system downstream of John Dewey is in any way profitable for our government. Yeah.
I think when you start talking about this, whether all these areas, morals, physical, prosperity, protection of life and property, this underlying philosophical references biblical views to these.
Yeah.
They can throw this completely in thousands of directions.
Yeah.
Okay. What is physical prosperity? What is that?
Yeah.
Should we all have a car and a chicken and a pot?
Yeah, right.
Should we all have free health care?
Right.
You know,
right.
Suddenly you just open up Pandora's box with so many directions. And the same is true with education.
Yeah.
Education has an underlying philosophical direction where you
can. Yeah. Yeah.
Thomas Dewey would say we need to get our country to John Dewey.
Yeah.
Wrong Dewey. So John Dewey said that, that we need to get our nation organized, and we have all these immigrants coming in, we need to have a common narrative.
Uh-huh.
Who defines the narrative?
Yeah, right.
Okay, so
right.
You open up so much there.
Yeah.
That you need to be incredibly careful.
You know,
and when the government gets involved,
yeah.
And then you could flip it over the other side.
Yeah.
The church gets involved in these
things. Mm-hmm.
Is it the church's business sometimes to get involved in some of these areas?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Proactively.
Mm-hmm.
So you're treading on thin ice.
Yeah. Well, I think what that actually is illustrating is an important principle that I think we need to preserve in all these matters, is that the Bible and even theologians are pushing at the margins of principles in order to give people principles, the actual application of which belong to people who are actually in positions of authority. And they need to take principles and apply them in a myriad of ways, right? That's the nature of how actually biblical ethics is done, right? We begin with 10 commandments, and then we apply those across a whole society. And you know, those simple 10 commandments that any child can memorize becomes infinitely complex when you're talking about it expanded across a society as vast as America, right? You just have all of these ways in which we need to recognize there's just a whole host of prudence, basically biblical sanctified prudence, that those who are actually endowed with authority are called to exercise. And it's why we actually should respect that as Christians. It's one of the reasons I think it's not in keeping with the biblical principles that God lays out for us that we complain a lot about our magistrates. They have very difficult jobs to do, to be quite frank. They're jobs that require a lot of wisdom, and actually there's quite a burden upon them, in fact, to apply God's word in this very particular way to a world that suddenly, you know, has AI in it. What do we do? You know, Ahaj didn't have that in mind as a responsibility of government. What do we do with a world in which, you know, completely unleashed and unrestricted AI is a disaster waiting to happen? And at least in some measure, there needs to be some prudence exercised in how it's implemented. You know, that'd be just one example of how life gets very complex once you move past biblical principles. But yet, we shouldn't despair of the fact that God really does give those men wisdom in his scriptures, and principles more key. And even, you know, morality is defined for them. And we should hold them to those accounts. So there are, I would say, a myriad of prudential applications of these things. Then there are also ones that are just really plain. And, you know, this is what we talked about last time. They're direct contradictions of God's law in, for instance, the seventh commandment, biblical ethics with relation to sexuality, marriage, murder. You know, those are the kinds of the areas in which Christians can speak with the highest degree of certainty. And prudence is not really what governments need to have on those points. They need to have principle. They need to be given godly principle that abortion is murder, that sort of thing. Does that make sense? I think we should, to go back to that point I made, because I really want to drill this home, there is a whole host of areas in which governments are called to exercise their own sanctified prudence and wisdom. And I think that's in keeping with your point, Bob.
Pastor Broom?
Yeah.
It isn't that. I do think there's a tendency of religious people who write to try to disconnect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Going to homeschool and it's,
yeah.
Right? Just to kind of give up on the public sphere.
Yep.
Entirely. And it seems like you're making a pretty strong case that that's actually not, that we actually should be.
You know,
work harder to get
yeah.
the public sphere to be a more godly place
yeah.
instead of giving up on it entirely and just turning inward.
Yeah. I don't want to be confused in any way for defending the current public education industry. I think it would be fine if that were abolished in its current form. So if that's where you're leaning and you're wondering about my opinion on that matter, that's where I would go. But the point I don't want to cede is that government has no right to dictate. There's a kind of libertarian streak that sometimes a lot of Christians have that they say, see, that's why it's just a hard line, and we should cut them out of it altogether, as if they have no interest in that as a portion of the public good that they're called to give some order to. And I don't want to agree on that point, even though I would have, and I think you and I would share, many great concerns about public education. All right, let's move on to the next paragraph, which we won't dissect as thoroughly, but there is one little word in there that I want you to pay attention to. So the next paragraph, paragraph two, is, it is lawful for Christians to accept and execute the office of a magistrate when called thereunto. So this is directly, just by the way, in the framers of the confession, this is against Anabaptist theology, which would have said it was a sin to hold public office, for a Christian to hold public office. And, you know, the confession's coming out very, very clearly that you can take oaths of public office. Those are licit for Christians to accept and execute the office of a magistrate. When called thereunto, in the managing whereof, as they ought especially to maintain piety, justice, and peace, according to the wholesome laws of each commonwealth, so for that end they may lawfully, now under the New Testament, wage war upon just and necessary occasion. So again, Christian government can wage war. Just and necessary, I think just would be a war of aggression, in which, according to the principles of justice, a government says, for whatever reason, we must go to war for this cause. Necessary, I think the confession has in mind, when you're attacked, right? So when you're attacked, you have a right and a necessary right to defend yourself. So it's sort of signing off on the principle of just war theory there. But the phrase that I think is quite interesting for our purposes is this one: maintain piety, justice, and peace. You know, I think we think of government being called to maintain justice and peace, and again, that's sort of the ceiling of our expectations here. But it's interesting to reflect that the confession includes piety in this list. And you might wonder, what does that look like? What does it look like for a government to maintain piety? Well, here's Hodge again. Christian magistrates should also seek, in their influential positions, to promote piety as well as order. This they are to do not by assuming the functions of the church, nor by attempting by endowments officially to patronize or control the church. Just by the way, that mention of endowments to patronize and control the church, that's a reference to 1800s Scotland. So in 1800s Scotland, one of the great ways in which the Scottish Presbyterian Church met its demise, really, was through the practice of patronage, in which it was instituted by law. Basically, those who were large landholders, the wealthy, had a greater say about who was a local minister in selecting ministers. And so wealth began to drive the bus in terms of who was actually in the pulpit. And this was, of course, to, you know, a lot of corruption in the Scottish Presbyterian Church in the 1800s. So this was something that they were all very animated, actually, across the Atlantic. So, for instance, John Witherspoon came from Scotland, and he was very animated about this. And you can kind of see that tradition go forward in Hodge here. So no patronage. But personally, he says, by their example. That's an interesting one. So let's just think about that. That they're to promote piety by their example. I think this is actually one in which we're all kinds of messed up. Like, we just have gotten to this place as a nation where we start saying things that I just don't think hold up according to historic Christian understanding. And one of the mainstays of historic Christian understanding is represented here in Hodge, is that character matters. Character matters. I said this, I think, in the first week. And it is a great and lamentable thing that we should just sackcloth and ashes as a society and as a church, that we live in a under government in which character doesn't matter, that we somehow deluded ourselves to think that that is indifferent. Now, is it the highest consideration? Are there other considerations? Yes, but it really does matter, and it should not be a totally wrong thing for Christians to hold our civil rulers to account in their marriages, for marriages or other areas of their life that are in deep delinquency. And I think Hodge is really talking about that. Personally, by their example, they uphold piety. Officially, by giving impartial protection and all due facility for the church in its work, so protecting the operations of the church, you know, if we were to be attacked on a Sunday morning, police would show up and protect us. By the explicit recognition of God and of Jesus Christ as ruler among the nations, and by the enactment and enforcement of all laws conceived in the true spirit of the gospel, touching all questions upon which the scriptures indicate the will of God specifically or in general principle, and especially, and notice here how relevant this statement is for our own day, and especially as touching questions of the Sabbath day, the oath, marriage and divorce, capital punishments, etc. So he's saying very directly, those are the list of things in which God did not stutter. He is not unclear. And he says that basically the upholding of piety is in the duty of government to uphold God's word on those points. And for us to, you know, promote civil government to that end. I'm going to hold on section 3, because section 3 is a really big section. This is a section that gets revised dramatically by the American Presbyterians, and there's a significant amount of historical reason for that, and I want to devote Sunday school just to section 3. I've included the text, and you can see actually how the change took place from the 1646 version of the Confession to the 1788 American Presbyterian version. And it's quite illuminating of this entire debate, because the Americans took a very different, decidedly different tact on this chapter. And we'll talk about what we think of that. We live under the American version, so we need to think about what's at stake in Section 3.